Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Ashling Wehner. In today's episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with Andrew Coy-Kendall, MD, who gave an overview of the myelofibrosis treatment paradigm. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Coy-Kendall discussed the prevalence of patients with myelofibrosis who have mutations in JAK2, CALR, or MPL, the crucial roles of the JAK1, JAK2, and IRAK1 pathways in disease progression, the importance of considering JAK inhibition in eligible patients, and the challenges associated with managing cytopenic myelofibrosis. Thank you so much, Dr. Coy-Kendall, for taking the time to speak with us today about the myelofibrosis treatment paradigm. So just to start off, how prevalent are mutations like JAK2, CALR, and MPL in patients with myelofibrosis?
Yeah, so most patients with myelofibrosis, 90% or more will have a mutation in one of those three, right? JAK2, MPL, or CALR. We think about them as being mutually exclusive because patients typically just have one of the three, but sometimes they rarely will occur together. But for the most part, I think we can assume that most patients have one of those. And JAK2 is the most common. That's found in 60% or so of patients with myelofibrosis. CALR is next most common, maybe 25 to 30%. And then MPL is really the least common of the driver mutations, really found in around 5, maybe 7% of patients with myelofibrosis.
That being said, what are the roles of JAK1, JAK2, and IRAK1 pathways in myelofibrosis progression?
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't know if we fully understand kind of the relative kind of importance of each of those pathways. I mean, certainly we know JAK2 is important. I think we know the JAK2 mutations, right, are seen commonly within this disease. And also we know that MPL mutations and CALR mutations kind of activate the JAK-STAT pathway. And the hyperactive or constitutive activation of the JAK-STAT pathway is really pathognomonic for this disease. And the question then, though, is how important is JAK1? How important is IRAK1? How important are some of these other ancillary pathways? And I think that part's not as well known. The medications that we have currently approved for myelofibrosis are all JAK2 inhibitors. So ruxolitinib, pacritinib, momelotinib, fedratinib all hit JAK2. But they differ in what else they hit. And so JAK1 is something that's hit a little bit by ruxolitinib. So ruxolitinib is a JAK1, JAK2 inhibitor. Fedratinib is more strongly a JAK2 inhibitor with a little bit weaker JAK1 inhibitory potential. Pacritinib is really a potent JAK2 and really largely spares JAK1 altogether. And then momelotinib is more of a JAK1, JAK2 inhibitor as well. And so clearly JAK1 isn't required because pacritinib is still effective at reducing spleen size and improving symptoms. But we do think maybe some of the kind of unique differences between these JAK inhibitors may owe to different kind of levels of JAK1 inhibitory potential. But I don't think that's really well understood. I think we kind of have anecdotal reports of how patients may kind of have symptom control that differs between agents, and we tend to postulate, but maybe it's due to more JAK1 inhibition with Rux. And people have said maybe that's associated with maybe control of itching, but we still see itching control with more kind of JAK2 selective inhibitors too. So really unclear. And maybe there's a role in toxicity. We know JAK1s as a protein is involved in immune surveillance and in megakaryopoiesis and things like that. So perhaps some of the differential impacts on platelets that we see with pacritinib or maybe some of the side effects that we see increased non-melanoma skin cancers, perhaps that has something to do with JAK1, but I don't think that's been really well defined. And then going to IRAK1, I think that's even less well defined. And we know that IRAK1 and interleukin-1 signaling is important and kind of activates this NF-kappa-B inflammatory pathway, which we know may be associated with kind of differential symptoms that may not be impacted by JAK inhibitors and may play a role in some of the cytopenias as well. And so I think that pacritinib we know is an IRAK1 inhibitor. And again, we know that pacritinib really has this unique ability to be used in patients with low platelets, doesn't tend to worsen platelets. But, I don't know how much of that is from IRAK1 inhibition versus maybe lack of JAK1 inhibition. I think that's a little bit unclear, but we do know that as we're developing more agents that kind of hit this NF-kappa-B pathway, think about BET inhibitors, for instance, that it is an important pathway that has the potential to augment clinical responses in terms of better spleen control, symptom improvement, as well as maybe a less deleterious impact on blood counts.
What are some common challenges that currently exist with myelofibrosis symptom management?
Yeah, this kind of concept of cytopenic myelofibrosis is relatively new, but I think it owes to the fact that myelofibrosis is really not one disease. It's probably a lot of diseases rolled into one heading, if you will. But I think if you were kind of to arbitrarily create cut points within the disease, you could say that there's this proliferative myelofibrosis, these patients that present with higher blood counts, more prominent splenomegaly. These are patients that typically have, you know, fewer additional mutations, really. It's usually just a JAK2 mutation or a driver mutation that's really playing the biggest role there. And these are patients that, you know, do really, really well with single agent ruxolitinib or fedratinib, like JAK inhibition that kind of improves some of the splenomegaly disease related symptoms. And then they usually have blood counts that can tolerate the myelosuppressive nature. So maybe the blood counts drop a little bit, but they start from an okay place. And so in cytopenic myelofibrosis, that's more defined by having at least one cytopenia, whether it's anemia, neutropenia, or thrombocytopenia. Anemia is the most common, thrombocytopenia next most common, neutropenia is quite rare. But typically these patients have disease that's driven not just by a driver mutation, but also additional mutations, maybe splicing mutations involving U2AF1 or SRSF2. So it's a bit of a more complex disease that has some more MDS-like features to it. And so it creates a challenge for treating with normal JAK inhibitors, because while these patients can have splenomegaly or symptoms, they can't typically tolerate the myelosuppressive nature of ruxolitinib and fedratinib. And so it makes it quite difficult to provide these agents at appropriate doses, because they may run into needing blood transfusions or lower platelet counts that put them at risk for bleeding. And so often in cytopenic myelofibrosis, where we have pre-existing lower blood counts, that creates a challenge where we have to dose modify and also leads to early discontinuation of standard JAK inhibitors. And that's where agents such as pacritinib and momelotinib, since their approval, have really allowed us to expand the benefit of JAK inhibitors to a broader population. So patients that are presenting with lower red blood cells, hemoglobin, hematocrit, or lower platelet counts. And so specifically, pacritinib is approved for patients with markedly low platelets, so less than 50,000. When it got approved, we really didn't have anything else we could use in that space. And momelotinib is approved for broadly myelofibrosis and anemia. But I think we've seen from kind of retrospective reviews as well as prospective clinical trials that both of these agents can be leveraged in patients that have lower blood counts with the expectation of being effective, controlling symptoms, improving spleen size, and really stabilizing blood counts, perhaps improving them, especially in patients that are switching from ruxolitinib over to pacritinib or momelotinib. And so I think that the main thing those agents have done is really allow patients with quote-unquote cytopenic myelofibrosis to derive those spleen and symptom benefits from JAK inhibition that they may not have been able to get the full benefit from previous to that. With four different approved JAK inhibitors, the question is how to sequence them, how to leverage them in different spaces where some overlap. And so, you know, certainly in extreme cases where patients have good blood counts, big spleens, lots of symptoms, right? Ruxolitinib is really our mainstay there. Fedratinib also has great data there as well. In patients with, you know, really, really low platelets of 10, 20 and big spleens, right? Pacritinib makes a ton of sense there. And in patients who are requiring transfusions, you know, maybe momelotinib makes sense there as well. So I think in those areas, it's clear cut, but I think there's more nuanced areas, right? Where you have kind of milder anemia with some spleen and symptoms, and it's unclear exactly, you know, what agent could be used there. So I think the biggest factor I think about is talking with patients to see what's kind of driving their, you know, their current symptom burden the most, right? Is it disease-related symptoms? Is it splenomegaly? Is it cytopenias? Is it kind of being tied to the healthcare system, needing transfusions, things of that nature. And then trying to figure out the agent that you think impacts that the most. And then I typically start with that agent with the understanding that we have backup plans. You know, if some other kind of concern becomes the more prominent one, we can back off. So a good example would be someone who comes in with a hemoglobin of 9, 9.5, you know, spleens enlarged, but really they're having a lot of constitutional symptoms. Well, you know, I think in that patient, you could think about using momelotinib because of the anemia. But if symptoms are the main concern, we know that in the SIMPLIFY-1 trial, ruxolitinib was better than momelotinib in terms of symptom improvement. And so I may start with ruxolitinib there, right? With the caveat that if the blood counts drop and now transfusions are needed, you know, I may switch, right? And so we counsel patients on all these different options and understand the first choice may not be the ultimate kind of best choice down the road. And But at the same time, I want to give the patient the best chance to derive the benefit they're looking for the most with our initial treatment.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back throughout the week for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On X and Blue Sky, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms, so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.